Talk given Saturday, 14th February 1981. Those of you who were here last month will remember we considered certain points in connection with the doctrine of karma and the meaning of the word and so on. And we saw that the commoner garden idea of retributive justice was a hopelessly wrong idea. The phrase itself is self-contradictory, because justice has nothing to do with retribution. In actual fact, if you look at it with the understanding of a developed religious consciousness, you will see that karma has nothing to do with rewarding good and punishing evil. But it is concerned with justice. So it behoves us to understand, to try to understand, in which way karma works out as justice in the entire karmic process. You may recollect also, I mentioned Aristotle's idea of justice. He said justice was the practice of virtue towards others. Now this is extremely important. Justice is the practice of virtue towards others. He didn't qualify how many others or which others. All others have been implied in it, you see. And therefore we see immediately the important position which virtue holds in the entire karmic process. Now, the karmic process is one which is concerned with coming to fulfillment, to bringing to fruition everything that the creative energy of the universe has produced in terms of a whole cosmos. In the process, we experience, as human beings, we experience pleasure and pain, joy and sorrow. But this is all included in the karmic process, not as a meeting out of happiness for good and as unhappiness or misery for evil done. The way the karmic process is understood is extraordinarily inadequate. You know how especially in countries like India, all those who believe in the karmic law, as they call it, and associate it with rebirth, past lives and future lives, they hold the individual living now as being responsible for those thoughts, feelings, actions which produce this particular result in this life. Now, if you come to look at that idea carefully, you will find that it just won't hold water. Consider for a moment natural disasters, accidents, and man-imposed sorrows and troubles. Let's deal with what man imposes. Take, for instance, the atomic bomb. And today, the hydrogen bomb. That atomic bomb on Hiroshima killed off 100,000 people straight away. Just like that. And a modern hydrogen bomb, in half a second, would kill off 3 million people. 30 times as many as the Hiroshima bomb. Now, those who believe in the sort of exact mathematical working out of karma would say that all those 3 million people, confine ourselves to Hiroshima, all those 100,000 people had done this, that or the other in past lives, which brought them together in Hiroshima somehow or other, and they paid the penalty. Well, now just think of it. Is the chances against such a coincidence of circumstance are tremendously against such a thing happening. It just won't happen. It's perfectly ridiculous. And just what did those 100,000 people do to deserve an atomic explosion like that on them? You see, the whole thing is completely out of proportion. Can you imagine any human being committing such a terrible crime that he deserves to be exploded with an atomic bomb? Or even worse, maimed for life and ruined for life if he happens to survive it physically? It's just not possible. It doesn't work that way. It's a hopelessly wrong idea. There is this element in situations of this sort, that people happen to be together at that particular time. Man has invented a horrible thing like these destructive bombs. There is a state of war between the nations. Each nation is, of course, bent upon what it calls victory, and it has to achieve that victory at any cost, however horrible, however evil, however unmoral, inflicted upon that upon the enemy nation. And therefore, when somebody drops an atomic bomb, it is not a question, it is not a case of the karma of all those hundreds of thousands, or as in the future it would be, the millions of people having done something in the past which deserved that. These things don't happen that way. If you look at it very, very carefully, it's a hopelessly absurd idea that each person is actually paying exactly for what he has done in the past. Again, if you consider carefully what happens when a person does a thing, it never is a case of that person being solely responsible for that act. There are so many other factors involved in that act. So many other people have been involved in it. Our upbringing, our education, the beliefs and convictions that we have about ourselves, our desires, our passions, all these are involved in it. And they are not... the sole responsibility of any one person. Just think this out very, very carefully and take a long time thinking it out. All over the world, any person's action is not due entirely to his volition and his original desire to perform that action. There are innumerable factors involved in that action. There are actions like this, for instance, where that is not the case. A fly comes and settles on your hand or your nose or something, and you just do that. Now that action, well, it has no karmic consequences afterwards, except for the fly perhaps, which has to fly away. But funniness apart, karma seriously does not work in that manner. You have to think this out very carefully for yourself. And one has to drag in the idea of rebirth, of past lives, of future lives. one has to bring in the idea of the keeping of accounts, meticulously accurate accounts, and of having a system of equivalence, that such and such an act or thought or word will bring forth just this result and no other. Otherwise we say it is not just. Our whole idea of justice is unfortunately bedeviled by our 20 shillings for a pound note mentality. We all have that. The equivalence, even such a genius as Plato used that idea of equivalence when he presented justice as the harmony, the effective harmony of the whole. And in developing that idea in the Republic, he mentioned that a man should have a position in the state which enables him to fulfill his natural ability and capacity, and that he should give to society the equivalent, he said, the equivalent of what he receives from society. How do we measure this equivalence? Is there any possible way of measuring equivalence in these matters? You can only measure equivalence in an arbitrary system of weights and measures, and so many pence for so many hours, so many tens of pounds for so many hours of work per day. You see, the whole picture of the karmic process as existing in the minds of those who think of karma and who believe in the karmic law, as they call it, the whole picture is hopelessly false. It just doesn't work like that. Again, consider the effect of a single thought or a single word. You get philosophers like Karl Marx and others like him producing their cryptic statements. Workers of the world, unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains. Well, they have united in so many parts of the world, and what have they done as a consequence? Have they really lost their chains, or are they still enchained with their desires, their greed for more and more, for giving less and less, more privileges, more rights, and so forth? Mind you, this doesn't apply only to the totalitarian countries. It applies to us here too. See what's happening and how it is happening. People never go to the heart of the matter, to the root of all these problems and difficulties, which lie within our own natures. And this is of primary importance to understand this, if we are to see justice come into being. What I have said so far is to help us to understand that it is our concepts of justice which are faulty. I have already mentioned this 20 shillings for a pound note idea of justice. That's a hopelessly faulty idea, because you can't allocate the equivalence of any act that any person does. How can you and I measure it? How can an equivalence be granted? If a person is a thief, or if he is a dishonest man and does not fulfill, carry out his word, his spoken word, breaks his agreement, doesn't sign his contract or whatever it is, well, you can't work out an equivalence of his action in terms of some something which will be dealt unto him. You can't do it. Consider what has happened in the past. Way back, we have had the Mosaic Law. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot, and so on. The Mosaic Law. It's distinctly stated in so many words in Exodus chapter 21, particularly starting at verse 24. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth comes in verse 24, you see. And the Mosaic Law is worked out in that way. And you will see that here was a supreme teacher, a great teacher, a holy one, who did liberate the Israelites out of Egypt, you see, and so forth. And who was able to enter the deep states of consciousness in which the Lord God tells Moses, go to the Israelites, if they ask you who hath sent you, say to them, Ehiye Asher Ehiye. One of the profoundest statements in scriptural terms. And it was he who laid down this somewhat savage and barbarous law. Consider again the code which Draco in Greece laid down for administering justice. Draco was a thesmothete, that is, a lawgiver and a lawmaker. He was one of the archons of the Athenian Eupatridae, which was a body of archons whose business it was to make the laws and see that they were carried out. Now, Draco drew up a code which was simplicity itself and also the perfect embodiment of horror and savagery. The simple punishment for all offenses, if you please, was death. That was that. Solve a population explosion problem, perhaps. But I think even in his day, people didn't quite feel that this was justice. All offenses were punished by death. And any code of laws, any system of justice, which is extremely harsh and cruel, is called draconian. He immortalized himself by laying down something terribly savage and evil. Consider again the state of affairs in India in the time of the Buddha. All the punishments meted out for any sort of crime were incredibly savage and barbarous punishments. It's hard to believe that in the India of the time of the Buddha, just a century, hardly a century after the golden age of the Upanishads, when great spiritual teachers flourished and all the rest of it, the system of laws and the administration of justice should be so terribly evil. Think again of the time of the Emperor Chandragupta Maurya, just about two centuries, a couple of centuries after the time of the Buddha. Chandragupta flourished between 304 BC and a little earlier, somewhere around that period, you see. He built his empire, he established empire by ruthless conquest and with the assistance of the political philosophy and ideas of a Brahmin called Chanakya. His name was Chanakya, and he was the person who compiled the political philosophies which had been handed down through the centuries in India. And it's a terrible book. I've got the complete translation of the Arthashastra, as it is called, with me. And the punishments laid down are simply barbarous. Not so terribly bad as in the time of the Buddha, but still very barbarous indeed. Think again of China. China has been noted in history for being a country which produced marvelous art, beauty, and philosophy and poetry and so forth, and at the same time had the most cruel punishments meted out to criminals. China's history, as has been said by a very impartial and a first-class historian, has been written in blood, in red. We can think of Europe and England and America right up to the end of the 19th century. Consider the treatment of slaves in America. And England was responsible for starting the slave trade. Captain John Hawkins and the others found it very profitable to go to Africa, capture these people who lived quite simple, innocent lives according to their understanding of life, and then sell them as slaves in America. And the treatment meted out to them, I think most of you, if not all of you, have read Uncle Tom's Cabin, and you'd know something about the way slaves were treated. In this country, children used to be hanged for stealing bread. In the 19th century this happened. And from earlier centuries onwards, Quakers, prostitutes, and vagrant women were publicly flogged most cruelly. Particularly the women. It was a super patriarchal tyranny which prevailed. Then there is the Inquisition which took place. Now, is all this justice? Here were these people, Torquemadas and whatnot, who burnt people alive in order to save their souls, whether they wished their souls to be saved or not. That didn't matter. They had to save their souls, so they burnt them alive at the stake. I have sometimes burnt my fingers in the laboratory, going over a Bunsen flame, stretching out for something, forgetting that there was a Bunsen flame there, and I know what a fierce thing fire can be. What must it be like to be burnt alive? And this was regarded as justice. They all believed they were doing the right thing in this. And today, the laws of the world have changed a lot for the better in so many respects. But contrast Islamic law and non-Islamic law. The two systems of law are very, very different from each other. Islamic law is still very medieval and very harsh and cruel. Now the question arises, how did vengeance and cruelty creep into the administration of justice in practice? The root source of the trouble seems to me to have been that the relationship between man and man throughout the ages has never been one of true human response to any man's action, but they have been pure thoughtless reaction against a person who did something which one didn't like. These reactions express the primitive passions of undeveloped persons, subhuman people. They express their fears and hates. One must also remember that in certain situations the law had to be very, very harsh, very strict. This applied to nomadic tribes which lived in desert-like or semi-desert regions of the world. These nomadic groups, small tribes, the chief had to exact absolute obedience to the law laid down. punish any infringement of the law very, very severely, because otherwise the tribe was in danger of decimation or enslavement by other tribes around them. This has held very much in the Central Asian lands and so forth. Now, another source of trouble with the justice not being true justice is just the frustration we experience in the pursuit of our desires, our pleasures, our ambitions, and our intense longing to express ourselves, as we call it. All this frustration arouses hate, fear, and violence, which moves us to hurt or destroy that which frustrates us. Even some geniuses have gone astray in their understanding of this. Philosophers like Hegel and Fichte, who extolled the great ego, the individual. You see, by that century, the idea of the individualism was growing very, very rapidly. John Locke of England was probably one of the early people. Descartes and Malebranche, a century or more before him, were responsible for starting that movement, which made John Locke and John Stuart Mill and other English philosophers propound the doctrine that each person was an individual answerable only to himself. The soul was a mental atom, unrelated to, and this is where John Locke went hopelessly wrong, unrelated to any other mental atom, any other soul in the world. Therefore, the greatest good of the individual was to be obtained by following just exactly what one's own desire drove him to fulfill, and fulfill it anyhow, at the expense of the other. That was the origin of what turned out in the next century as laissez-faire and rampant individualism. And so you had the spectacle of the few cunning, capable ones who made themselves very rich at the expense of hundreds and thousands of miserable poor people, and sowed the seeds which have worked their way, as you see, right up to our own day historically, in the relationships between the different groups of people in our own country here. So now, Hegel actually advocated the ruthless extermination of anything that stood in the path of the great ego. If a person was a big ego, he postulated the divine as the supreme ego, the absolute self. And the individual was a reflection of that absolute self. If he recognized his own great ego and had his own ambitions and pursuits and so forth, and found anything in his way, he had the right to just wipe it out. And you see how that worked out in German history. The Bismarckian movement, which ended up ultimately with the First World War, and then the master race and the Herrenfolk and so forth, which ended up with the Hitlerian regime and so forth. So all these ideas, all these factors have bedeviled the understanding of what pure justice means. This savage, subhuman justice, so-called, has flourished because man, as man in the mass has not had any true vision of the purpose of existence, no vision of his own divine potentiality, no understanding that the whole universal process works for the, as far as man is concerned, for the man to come to fruition as the perfect man, the perfected Holy One. I won't expatiate on it. You have often heard me say that the very word human means divine, the blissful creator, the happy creator. But man has had no idea of that really, and nor has he understood his own real nature as it is here and now. He has had no self-knowledge. He has only had these inherent drives, inherent through natural evolution, through the primordial animal stage to the human stage, and that which has been imposed upon him by his socio-cultural heritage. You see? These are the factors we must bear in mind. And yet, through the centuries, there have been just those few, the few who were realized beings, perfected holy ones, who understood what the whole karmic process was about, and its true nature, and how divine justice is manifested and exemplified throughout history. With all, including, of course, I'm including all these terrible things that have happened. They are not divine justice by any means, but they form those unhappy, growing pains, and very painful those pains have been for the human race through the millennia. These realized human beings saw clearly that the purpose of justice was not to reward the good doer or to punish the evil doer, but to heal, to make whole everybody, good doer and evil doer alike. And this is the important point, that justice has to function in such a manner that he who has done some criminal act and he who has suffered from the criminal act are both helped to get into right relationship with themselves, with each other, with their whole situation and society, and come to fruition through understanding everything and therefore knowing how to act rightly in the world. Consider the words of Jesus, "Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." What words these are! Be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Now the significance of those, of that statement, Christendom hasn't even begun to understand. Jesus bent all his energy towards helping all people to come to their fruition. And he spent his whole life in that. He suffered on account of it, with the suffering of all humanity, the sinfulness of all humanity. And he gave his life as a ransom for the many, a statement which is gloriously misunderstood. Many people dislike that statement in the Gospels. They don't want Jesus Christ to take upon himself what they themselves do wrongly. But they don't understand the process of life and the process of evolution and growth. Therefore, they rebel against such a statement. They are too egotistic, too self-concerned, too self-centered, too separative and isolative in their own inward consciousness. That is why they rebel against that, instead of realizing what a tremendous thing it is. And then finally, he gave his life on the cross. And on the cross he said, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they do." Therefore the forgiveness. This is divine justice, if you like. And you will see that divine justice actually, therefore, includes martyrdom. Whenever you and I, if we try to do some good to our families or our society and so forth, and we suffer in the process of trying to do good for them, then that is just that we suffer. The ordinary person would say, "What nonsense! How can I be made to suffer for doing good to this young rascal who is misbehaving and so forth?" But that is the case, because consider it: if you become the perfected Holy One, can you go into the pub next evening or the same evening and mix with those people and be at one with them? And they will sense it. They will know you are different. And they will hate you for it. And they'll dislike you. And they will hurt you for it. This is one of the extraordinary phenomena in the whole history of the human race in terms of human relationships. But this is part of divine justice. This is if we understand this, we understand the meaning of compassion. Passion comes from passio, passere, to suffer. To suffer. Passion means suffering. And compassion means suffering together with. So that if I am the evildoer, the wrongdoer, you suffer with me because of my wrongdoing. And that is divine justice as far as you are concerned, and also as far as I am concerned. Because it is I who get redeemed, you are the redeemer. You don't get rewarded for being a redeemer. These are perhaps very upsetting things to talk about, because those of us who sort of have had all the conventional beliefs about rebirth and karma and all the rest of it, all this sweeps all that aside. But I trust that I'm not a mere iconoclast who breaks down the house which gives you some sort of shelter from freezing weather and so forth. But that what I have said helps you to understand something profounder, something deeper, so that you yourself do not continue to make mistakes which you would make inevitably if you held mistaken views. That is the point. But whosoever helps you to clarify your views will necessarily suffer the consequences, suffer the pain of clarifying the views of others. This is one of the very difficult things to accept in connection with the karmic process. But if you really see this, then you will see that in the truly healed or holy state, there is neither pain nor pleasure, neither sorrow nor joy, but there is present only the great peace, pure bliss. Bliss has nothing to do with joy and happiness as we experience it and understand it. Nothing to do with it at all. The state of bliss, which is the state of utter peace, the peace that passes all ordinary understanding. In India we called it ananda, bliss. It is the sublime, unoriginated nirvana itself.